Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Man first landed on the moon in the summer of 1969, 57 years ago. Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin held the attention of the world in the palms of their hands during that first United States manned landing. But humans, Americans, last went to the moon 3 short years later. Apollo 17 landed on December 11, 1972, with the mission ending on December 19th. We went to the moon, in part, to beat the Soviets to that feat. And we went largely because President John F. Kennedy inspired a generation to do so and made it a goal to put men on the moon by the end of the 1960s.
Why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win.
We did win, but after a half dozen trips, we seem to have lost interest. NASA certainly lost funding. At its peak in 1966, the space agency's budget amounted to 4.4% of the federal budget. By 1975, it fell below 1%, where it has stayed ever since. And, of course, public interest, gauged by TV ratings, demonstrated that enthusiasm had fallen off a cliff. I guess NASA couldn't justify the cost when the public wasn't paying attention. But now we may be in a new space race, this time with China, and that is pushing us again. Since 2017, NASA has been working on the Artemis program, the next generation of vehicles designed to carry astronauts to the lunar surface. And next month, Artemis II is scheduled to launch its first crewed mission to orbit the moon in preparation for one to follow, which would include a lunar landing. Despite our fascination with space travel as witness to the popularity of movies and TV shows like Star Wars and Star Trek and Apple TV's For All Mankind, space exploration for real needs to recapture America's imagination and convince some naysayers that this is money well spent. Winston Scott understands all this. He served as the mission specialist for the space shuttles Endeavour and Columbia and is the resident astronaut at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex, and he joins us for the hour. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
You're welcome. We were supposed to do this last week, but our mission was scrubbed. It was postponed because of a missed flight or something like that. But now you're
here. That's a good way to put it. Yeah, my flight got canceled on me at the last minute, so I wasn't able to make it in time. But it's good being with you this morning.
Yeah. So let me just get an update on where we are with the Artemis II mission, because it too has been postponed yet again. And you just told me before we started this conversation on the air that they're actually going to roll back the whole launch assembly, the rocket, back to, I guess, the garage. For maintenance, right. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, NASA just conducted what they call the wet dress rehearsal, which is essentially fueling the rocket completely up as if it's going to launch, and then conducting a countdown. And during that countdown, they test every system, every procedure for every person, every team, and so on, down to the minute of launch without actually doing it. Well, at the end of this wet dress rehearsal, they discovered some more leaks, you know, the infamous leaks that keep occurring. And this time it was helium flow rate in the interstage that occurred. So bottom line is they cannot repair it at the pad, so they have to roll it back to the vehicle assembly building. Now, remember, rolling this thing back to the vehicle assembly building is an all-day event because it only travels at maybe 1 mile per hour. The vehicle assembly building is not like your typical automobile garage or aircraft hangar. This thing is over 500 feet high because it has to accommodate this entire rocket inside of it. So once again, we're delayed with the launch date for Artemis 2, and we will see what happens.
Let me ask you a stupid question. We've been doing this for a while. We've been launching rockets now for a while, and we've been launching rockets that intend to carry personnel on top of them. And yet we still have these problems of these finding leaks in these things, which is why you test them before you fire them off. But why? Why do we keep finding these leaks? Why haven't we perfected this?
You know, I wish I could give you a good answer because some of the other rocket companies, SpaceX, for example, Blue Origin, some of them launch routinely, and the SpaceX is launching routinely with people. They're not seeing the same issues that we're seeing with our space launch system and with the Dreamliner last year. Remember when Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams went up for an 8-day flight, stayed 9 months. They were plagued with leaks. I want to be careful not to point fingers, but the common denominator is the prime contractor. They're having some struggles lately, and perhaps that is the issue. But you're right. You know, these gases are very, very difficult to contain. You know, helium and hydrogen are number one and two on the periodic table. So they got the smallest molecules, and they're therefore the most difficult to contain. But on the other hand, like you said, we've been doing this for decades now and doing it well and doing it consistently. So why we're suddenly plagued with just leak after leak after leak after leak is a problem that we need to get a hold of and we need to fix it.
Yep, because there have been six moon landings, I think 135 shuttle missions, if I'm right about
Yes.
that, not to mention launches to carry astronauts to the space station and back. Alan Shepard flew the first manned Mercury mission, the suborbital Freedom 7 mission in 1961. That was a long time ago,
Thank you. Long time
65
ago.
years ago.
Yes.
More Mercury missions followed, of course. They were followed by Gemini, then Apollo. We have learned a lot, I would
Learned
imagine.
a lot.
So why are we now returning to a place that we've been to before?
Let me get to that. Let me correct something. We're talking about helium leaks, and we have had helium leaks and hydrogen leaks. The specific problem we saw just now has to do with helium flow rate. So the helium wasn't necessarily leaking, as the amount of helium needed to flow to get the job done was below what it should be. So this is a helium flow rate problem. Same, it's the same gas, helium, but a little bit different problem. But be that as it may, we're going back to the moon for several reasons. We human beings need to branch out in the universe. If the human race is going to survive, we need to find another planet to live on. And if we're going to find another planet, we need to increase our capability of long duration space flight, long duration space living, and so on. The first step for that, of course, would be to go to the moon, this time with a permanent presence so that we learn how to live on the moon. We know, learn how to work on the moon. We learn how to stay there long term. And from there, we'll use the moon as a stepping stone to go off to Mars. That's the first planet we will probably visit. And then from there, who knows? So we need to get to the moon for that reason, just for the survival of the human race. And if we're going to go to the moon, we need to get there first because, as you mentioned in your open monologue there, we're in a race with China. China wants to beat us to the moon and get to the South Pole of the moon, where there's an abundance of water ice. And where there's water, we can sustain life, we can generate power, and so on. If China gets there first, they might likely put up a sign and say, all others keep out. So if we get there first, then we can sort of stake our claim, and then we welcome all others in. So that's another reason we need to get to the moon. We need to get to the moon soon. I
So
would like.
since we've had our astronauts living long term on the space station, I think one, the last I think you alluded to this, we had several who were stranded there for almost, I think, what, 11 months or something like that, maybe longer. So is there a difference between living long term in space in the space station versus living long term on the moon?
Oh, absolutely. There's a big difference in the space station. You just a space station is kind of like a camper, kind of like a big Winnebago, and you can supply it with rockets from the Earth. When you go off to the moon, you can't send rockets back and forth to supply it. We need to learn how to grow food on the moon. You know, will plants grow in moon regolith? Can we process the water on the moon, recirculate it and recycle it to drink it, to use it and bathe with it? Can we decompose that water into hydrogen and oxygen and generate power? So those are the things we can do on the surface of a planet or a body that we can't do living in a space station. So you figure a space station is kind of like your camper when you're on a campground, and the moon would be kind of like living at your house. So yeah, there's a big, big difference.
So
Proximity, I think I alluded to that, but proximity is very important.
the United States has had an unbroken presence in space pretty much since November of 2000. We've had somebody up there doing something, either orbiting the Earth or in the space station doing things. But at some have said that we have forgotten, I don't know if this is true or not, you can tell me, that we have forgotten how to get to the moon. We've had to relearn what those early flight technicians and astronauts and flight controllers knew or learned from the Apollo missions. Is that true, or is it merely that technology has changed, has progressed so much that we have to reinvent how we do this?
I don't necessarily think that we've forgotten how to do it. I think it's a combination of the two. A lot of that corporate knowledge has gone, but also the technology has advanced between the 1960s and now, and we're trying to build new moon rockets with new technology. So it's almost like starting from ground zero again. So it's a combination of the two. Also, some of the delays with the current moon program had to do with changing administrations. For a long time, each administration would come in and they sort of change things. One administration come in and say, "We're going to do this." The other one says, "No, we're not going to do that. We're going to go this way and go that way." And so it's a combination of the items that you mentioned.
And there have been changes in the way NASA handles things because NASA used to run everything. They built the
Yes.
rockets in cooperation with other companies, but they were it. But now we have all these other companies building rockets and actually assisting NASA in doing some of the missions that they have been involved in. What's the advantage of that, of bringing outsiders in? Will it ultimately lower the cost of these launches and space travel?
Yeah, I think it's a great thing that what NASA has done over the last decade or so is begin to partner with commercial space entities, and it's already working. If you look at what's happened with SpaceX, Elon Musk and SpaceX has significantly lowered the cost and access to space. In fact, we launched 103 rockets last year from Kennedy Space Center. Most of those were SpaceX. They launch regularly, launch on time, and they do so at a fraction of the cost of what NASA
Why
used to do.
is that?
So,
Why can Elon Musk and SpaceX do it
be,
cheaper?
because, be, because of his approach, Elon Musk is a businessman. And the government, let's go back to NASA. The government is very, very good at doing esoteric things, doing cutting-edge things. The government got us to the moon and back and so on. What Elon Musk did, he didn't have to start from ground zero. He took NASA-developed technology and he streamlined it. He directed it specifically towards what he needed to do. So he was able to cut out of the parts of the mission that he did not need, take that part that he did need and streamline it and therefore show efficiencies that the government can't possibly show. Yeah, Elon Musk is a businessman. He knows how to think in a cost-effective manner. His rockets won't do what NASA's rockets did because they don't need to. For example, NASA had to carry large pieces of the International Space Station into space, 50,000 pounds of low Earth orbit, things the size of a school bus. Well, Elon Musk's rockets won't do that, but he doesn't need to. So he could take NASA technology and focus it and thereby reduce the cost of access to space. And that's exactly what we want. If we think back on the aviation industry, the first. Can I keep
No,
going?
let's stop because we have
Okay,
10
all right.
seconds. Then we'll come back and you can finish
Sure.
that thought. And we'll also talk about the purpose and timing of these Artemis missions and what the role of an astronaut is these days. Winston Scott's our guest. He is an astronaut. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to an astronaut today. Winston Scott is a NASA shuttle astronaut with both Endeavour and Columbia. He's also the resident astronaut at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. And we're talking about the impending Artemis II mission, among other things, which will orbit the moon when it finally launches, hopefully, sometime next month. And we've been talking about the different approach to these new moon missions that NASA is taking as opposed to what they did in the Apollo era. And one of the things that SpaceX has been able to perfect, Elon Musk's company, is reusing the booster rockets. And it really is quite amazing because the booster rockets used to just fall into the ocean and maybe be recovered for scrap metal. And he has them land vertically in a precise location almost every time without fail. Are there elements of the Artemis rocket that will be similar to that? Can they be reused?
Yes, and let's be fair, the shuttle, the space shuttle was reused. Every part was reused except for the external tank. So you're right, the boosters, well, after they'd done their job, would parachute into the water. They'd be recovered, but they were refurbished and reused again. So the shuttle was actually the first reusable space vehicle that we built, with the exception of the big external tank. But before I get to that, let me make a point about the parallels between the evolution of our space program and the evolution of aviation. You know, when the Wright brothers invented the airplane and it matured to a certain extent, the first customer was the U.S. Army, the military. And then advancements in aviation occurred because of World War I, World War II, Korea, and so on. Then those advancements in aviation flowed out into the civilian community. When I was a kid, only rich people could afford to fly on an airliner. But because of the evolution, the involvement of business people into what was a government entity, aviation, anybody can fly. Anybody can buy a plane ticket now and fly in some place. So same thing happened with the space program. The early rockets and rocket development was done by the federal government. But then you get that technology filtering out into the civilian community with people like Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and so on. And the business community now has tailored those qualities down to what's needed for the civilian program, and thus make it more cost effective. So I'm trying to draw parallels between what happened in aviation and the lowering of costs, and the same thing that's happening to the space program with the lowering of costs. So back to your last point, what was it Mike said again to the board, and then I'll take off on that.
Oh, I was talking about the rockets, pieces of the Artemis being able to be used again.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. In fact, let me talk a little bit about that. What we see with SpaceX current rockets, you know, as you know, the first stage rockets go up. When they're done, they come back down and they land on a pad. And that's great. I guess fantastic. I love what's happening. But those rockets, again, are not the same size and same weight and same power as the ones that NASA used to launch the shuttle. So it's easy to bring them back to control their descent and land them on the pad. So again, it's an evolution from the reusable rockets that NASA used to the reusable rockets that SpaceX is using. It's just
I'm old enough to remember Alan Shepard and his first flight in 1961 and all of the other missions. And I have to confess that I am a space buff, and I would go in a nanosecond if you give me the opportunity. I'll be doing the show from the moon. It'd be fine with me. But NASA took a very methodical approach to this for people who were not alive in 1961. They started with single astronauts in the Mercury program. Then they went to Gemini, which had two astronauts. Then they went to Apollo, which had three astronauts. And the purpose of the three astronauts was two would land, one would be in the command module circling the moon. And in that first mission, it just so happens that the guy stuck in the capsule circling the moon was me.
Absolutely. So you've been there.
That's right. So, but along the way, we have had some accidents and we've had some tragedies, and you're sitting on top of a bullet. You're sitting on top of an explosive device as you are launched. Gauge for me the risks involved, not just in the launch, but just in the whole kit and caboodle, the whole mission.
Yeah. You know, the risks are high. This is a risky business. And, you can talk about numbers and the odds and all that stuff, but there's so many things that have to go right. Thousands and thousands of things have to go right. And any one thing that goes wrong could lead to disaster. And the accidents that we saw were quite often the result of something very, very small. Everybody sees the big things, the big problems, and we fix it, but we don't see the very, very small things. For example, the O-ring problem on the Challenger, or the shedding foam on the Columbia. We just didn't see those things happening. So it's just very, very, very risky business. But I would put out to the public that any gains made throughout history have been made with a certain amount of risk. I mean, when the early settlers came here to North America from Europe, look at the risk that they incurred just getting over here, and then the issues that they had to deal with once they arrived. When the early settlers in the US moved from the East Coast going west, the westward expansion, the risk that they incurred. So any kind of serious progress for human beings has come with significant risk. And I would say that the rewards are certainly worth the potential losses. Scientific
Since you've been
progress,
into
human
space,
progress, there's probably
since you've
risk.
been into space and you've flown on Endeavour and you've flown on Columbia, as an astronaut, you are aware of all these risks. You are aware that you're sitting on top of a bomb
Yes.
as you're being launched.
Yes.
You are aware that if the reentry doesn't go precisely right, you could burn up in the atmosphere. You're aware of all this.
Well,
What
you don't
goes
think
through your
about
mind? What goes
it.
through your mind, and
You
what do you think
don't
about?
concentrate on those things. You concentrate on what you're supposed to do. You have confidence in the vehicle and the people that worked on it and fixed it. You have confidence in yourself and your training and your colleagues. And I believe there's a psychology to it. You don't believe something bad is going to happen to you. Let's bring it down home again. You get in your car and you drive on the interstate. Look at all the accidents that occur on the interstate every day. We don't focus on that. If we worry about the accidents, we'd never get in our car and go anyplace. So, in my business as a naval aviator, flying airplanes off of ships and training for combat, and then flying the space shuttle, you just don't concentrate on it. You know what the risks are, but you feel as though you are going to come back alive. You're going to do well. Your ship is going to work properly, and that you can handle anything that comes up. It's part of the psyche, I think, that's needed to do this kind of work.
So NASA says that Artemis heralds, quote, a golden age of exploration and innovation, preparing humanity to live and work on the moon and paving the way for a crewed mission to Mars, which is something you've already alluded to. But aside from exercising the exploratory genes that humans have always displayed, otherwise there would be no United States of America because we'd still be in Europe. Aside from that, what's the advantage of sending humans when we now have robots that are almost fully human in terms of their being able to articulate their bodies, etc., and we can control them from a big computer on the ground? What's the advantage of sending human beings?
I think if our only goal was to learn about the moon and Mars, just to observe it, then yes, send robots. But human beings are created with the inherent need to explore. That's how we were made. And it really baffles me why some people would deny our basic makeup and give that over to machines. That's how we were made. We're supposed to explore. So aside from all the other reasons, we ought to go just because that's who we are. We're meant to grow, to explore, to overcome obstacles, to expand. So yeah, we always send people. And no matter how great the robots are, and they become more sophisticated every day, it's not a substitute for being there, for seeing, for touching, for feeling, for breathing, for actually being there. So I would say we ought to go simply because that's our nature to go. And if we deny our own nature, then we stop evolving. We stop growing. We stop becoming better and better human beings.
So it's been a long time since we've been to the moon. And as I alluded to, people lost interest in it because we kept going to the moon. We didn't go that many times, but we kept going. And after the first couple of times, people go, ah, we do it. That's how we do it. We do it fine. But then we have science fiction television and science fiction movies, which are so far ahead of where we are and what we can accomplish in space. It looks like we're driving a Model T while the movies are driving a God knows what. It takes a long time in between missions sometimes because you have to analyze what happened in the previous mission to make sure it went well and anything that went wrong can be corrected for the next one. That you have to be safe about this. That's why I guess it takes so much time. So if Artemis 2 goes off next month and it is successful, meaning that they will have successfully orbited the moon and safely returned to Earth, when will the next manned mission to the moon with a landing occur?
Yes, and you're right. It does take a long time, and partly because we only have one rocket, so we got to send it. We got to wait until it comes back to analyze everything, and then got to sort of build another one or fix this one or whatever. There's no specific date. If Artemis 2 goes off, say in March, and comes back, then it will be a year or two before Artemis 3 goes, and just for that reason, it just takes so long to analyze the data to build another rocket and so on. Contrast that with the space shuttle. We got to the point where we were launching five or six space shuttles a year because we had a fleet of four or five. So, and we got used to rapidly launching one right after another. So every couple of months or so, we were launching a space shuttle because we had a fleet of them. We had learned so many lessons from the previous flight that we could keep them going. But in this case, brand new program, brand new rocket. Yeah, there's a lot of time in between.
I'm actually surprised it's only one rocket. That really surprises me. Is that for
Well,
cost control?
because it's so expensive.
Yeah.
And I said that, but now I have to be careful because I'm not on the inside of the program. I'm sure other rocket components are being built as we speak. I don't think they're sitting around doing nothing until this one comes back. I'm sure other rockets are being fabricated. But how far do you go in the building of a second one when you don't know how well the first one works?
So you arrived at NASA in 92, served as a mission specialist on several different shuttle flights, STS-72 in 96, and in 1997 you flew on the STS-87. You spent more than 24 days in space. You've taken three spacewalks, during which you're outside the spacecraft for 19 hours and 26 minutes. I have to ask you, which gives you pause more, sitting on top of the rocket before it launches and going up, or being out in space with an umbilical cord?
I tell you what, that's a difficult question to answer. Neither one were alarming or frightening to me. They were both exciting. I can remember my very first flight, lying on my back as the engine spooled up and we were ready to launch. I was excited and ready to go. And the same thing with my first spacewalk. I was excited about it. I got outside and became adjusted, so to speak, adapted to the zero gravity with that 300-pound suit on my back. It was just very, very, very exciting. And so that's what this business is about. It's for people who are excited about those things and not hesitant or ready to pause in the face of doing the things that they signed up to do. Just exciting.
I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that you practice for these spacewalks underwater.
You do.
Is that
And
right?
yes, that's right. And that's not the same as being in space. What,
That's my
because
question.
There's no such thing as a zero gravity practice room. You can't go in and turn gravity off. So we put on a mock-up of the spacesuit. The water sort of floats the suit, and you pretend you're in weightlessness. That's not the same thing, but that's the best we can do. So the NutriBuoyancy Lab is the big fancy swimming pool type facility in which we practice spacewalking. Is our laboratory, our training facility, and it's excellent for going over procedures, for coordination between you and your spacewalking buddy, and so on. So if I had to put a number on it, I would say the training in the NutriBuoyancy Lab is maybe 70-80% of what it's like to actually walk in space.
Yeah, so describe for me, if you can, I'm not sure you can put it into words, the feeling of doing a spacewalk. What is it? What is the sensation of it?
There are no words to describe it because, again, you've got that bulky suit on your back. Now, it doesn't weigh anything, but you still have the 300 pounds of mass of the suit plus your body mass that you're moving. We call it space walking, but you move hand over hand. So it's very forearm hand intensive. So physically, it's the most difficult thing that we do in space. You have to learn to move in the suit without losing control of it. Because there's no resistance up there. Every movement you start, you have to stop, you have to control. So you learn how to control your body, control the suit, control what other masses you are moving in orbit. Plus the psychological effect. When you're in a pool training, you're still on Earth in a big pool. When you're in space, you're in space. If you look over and down at the Earth, you can see how high you are and how fast you're moving over the ground below you. So there's a psychological aspect to it. So overall, there are no words to adequately describe what it feels like to be there, but it's just an incredible sense of accomplishment when you successfully complete a spacewalk. You go out, you do what you need to do, and you get back in safely with a success. Just an amazing sense of accomplishment. I'm very
We know
happy to
there's
have
a
done.
we know that space is a vacuum. There's no air, there's no sound,
Right.
there's no
That's
smell.
right.
But yet I've spoken to other astronauts who have told me that once you come back in from a spacewalk and you close the hatch, there is a smell. Space has a smell. Are they right about that?
I'm not sure I agree with that, because once you close the hatch, you repressurize the airlock, and the first thing you do is you open the inner hatch, so the air rushes in from outside. So the only I'll tell you what, the only smell I remember is pulling off that spacesuit, and I smell like I'd been working out in the gym, because I had my I'm sweaty underneath. It's like going to the gym getting a workout. So what I remember smelling was just my
Self.
space underwear that needed to be laundered. That's right.
Because I was told by this other astronaut that there's a it's a burnt smell.
No, I think that's from the moon. The moon guys picked up a
Okay.
residue of a regolith of some kind that remained on their suits that they could smell after taking the suit off. See, we can have that in the vacuum of space, but the moon folks, I've read that, yeah, had that that smell. That's from leftover from the Apollo days.
And we have about a minute left in this segment, but you mentioned that one of the things we're trying to figure out is the effects of long-term, of being in space for long term. But we've been doing that with the space shuttle for a while now. So what's the difference between doing it on the moon and doing it in the shuttle? And what do we know about the long-term effects of being in a gravity-free environment?
Well, as you know, long is relative. 16 days in the space shuttle was relatively long, but that's nothing compared to 6, 8, 9 months on the International Space Station. Then when we send people back to the moon, they may stay for a year, they may stay for 2 years or whatever. So the length of time is relative. And the body does deteriorate in zero gravity. And we need to understand the effects of this deterioration, because if we're going to go off on long duration flights, for example, to Mars, a mission to Mars would be 2 or 3 years in duration. What does zero gravity do to the body over 2 or 3 years? What does the space radiation do to the body? When you're in low Earth orbit, we're still protected by the Earth's magnetic field. Once we go to the moon, you don't have the Earth's magnetic field to protect you, so there's radiation. And then you go off to the Mars, there's even less radiation. So all those things are important to understand.
Winston Scott's our guest. He's a NASA shuttle astronaut. We'll come right back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to an authentic, bona fide astronaut. Winston Scott flew on both the Endeavour and Columbia shuttles. He's a resident astronaut, the resident astronaut at the Kennedy Space Center Visitors Complex. I have 1,000 questions and a very limited amount of time, so here we go. This is the lightning round.
All right.
Artemis 2, scheduled to fly on Artemis 2, which is scheduled to launch next month to orbit the moon, is Christina Koch, who's a native of Grand Rapids, Michigan, but she grew up in Jacksonville, North Carolina, and attended NC State University. Her official NASA bio describes her as an explorer and engineer who became an astronaut in 2013. She spent time in 2019 aboard the International Space Station, and she, like you and others in the astronaut pool, has an engineering background. Is that one of the prerequisites for being an astronaut these days, to have an engineering background or an avionics background or an aviation background?
The criteria is to have a background in a technical subject of some kind. Most astronauts do have engineering backgrounds, but some don't. Some are physicists, some might be meteorologists, even some geologists. When we go back to the moon again, we certainly need geologists. We also have medical doctors, and the medical doctors typically are flight surgeons, so their medical specialty has something to do with flying, because space flight is a flying business. So technical education, usually engineering, but not always engineering.
So, if a young person is listening who has this desire to follow in your footsteps, what path would you suggest?
First and foremost, as I just said, a technical education, advanced education, minimum of a master's degree, maybe PhD if they want to be a true scientist. If you want to be a pilot astronaut and flying in spaceships are still flying vehicles, so you're going to need somebody who knows how to pilot the thing, then still, you got to have that college degree, master's degree, engineering, military. Flying is still the best way to do. All the pilots still come from the military, so
Many
I would urge them to consider
And many astronauts have been test pilots in the military over time. Artemis is not just a mission or two. It's a series of increasingly difficult missions to the moon. The first time we took one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind, we played golf on the moon and planted the flag and little else. But then the missions got bigger as time went on. What's planned for all these Artemis moon landing missions? What do they plan to do while they're there?
Yes, again, Artemis is the purpose is to put people on the moon with a permanent presence this time. We want to build habitats. We want to have people live and work there for the purposes of learning how to live on the moon. So it involves engineering, it involves science, it involves exploration, it involves psychology, communities working together. How do people fare together when they're living off the planet Earth for long periods of time? So all of those things are planned, and all those things are very important to understand.
Yeah, it brings up something interesting. It's one of the things that the Apple TV show For All Mankind explores, and I don't know that you've seen it or not, but it is a fictional reenactment of the space race of the 1960s to the present day, in which the Russians made it first to the moon and not the Americans. But one of the things that they deal with, not just the physical effects of being in space for a long period of time, but the psychological impact of it, because you're away from your family, you're away from your friends, you're with the same group of people. Hopefully you get along, maybe you don't. But there's also just the idea of being in this box. You can't just go out into the sunshine whenever you want to. It doesn't happen that way. How do we understand the psychological effects of being in space?
No, we do not understand the psychological effects, and we won't until we go there and do it. You know, the most complex part of any exploration equation is the human being. You know, we can build ships, we can build navigation facilities, power plants, and so on. We can't build people, and we still don't quite understand the human being. So that's going to be one of the biggest variables in the success and the in success of any exploration mission.
Some have said that we will probably never go to Mars because it's too dangerous, it takes too long, rescue would be difficult, if not impossible, and if we needed to rescue somebody and were unable to do so, I think people on the Earth might rebel. So with the dawn of AI and humanoid robots, will it be necessary for us to go to Mars, or can we just send them? This is kind of a duplicate of the question I asked you earlier, but I guess the better question is, tell me why it's important, because you said earlier that we have to prepare for mankind to have other places to go in the universe, which indicates to me that perhaps the Earth is at risk, and perhaps it is from climate change. But is that, I mean, that would be thousands of years in the future, right?
It actually is billions of years in the future. Yeah, you and I won't be around then, but billions of years.
Speak for yourself.
Speak
for yourself.
if the human species, if human beings are going to survive, we're going to have to go someplace else. And it's got to start now, because the planets that are being discovered that are remotely Earth-like are trillions of years away. They are hundreds of thousands of light years away, which equates to trillions of miles away. So we're going to have to start now to learn how to find those planets and get there. If we send robots, that's not doing much to teach human beings how to live in space and how to go out and explore. If you want the robots to survive after Earth is gone, that's fine, send them. We want people to survive, then we're going to have to send people out, and that starts now with the moon and then Mars and then beyond, as they say.
So these Artemis missions will be marked by biology experiments, I understand, aimed at determining the deep space effects, which we've talked a little bit about, on the human body, including dry and wet saliva experiments, if you know about this, and avatars, a virtual astronaut tissue analog response is what avatar stands for. Why are they necessary, given that we've already sent people to the moon many times before, and we've had people living in the space station for long periods of time?
Yes, but when we sent people to the moon before, we didn't conduct any of these experiments. We got to the moon, as you said earlier, primarily as a political move to beat the Soviet Union. And when we went to the moon, what we did was bring back rocks. It was primarily geological in nature. There were virtually no medical experiments that took place on the moon. So we're really kind of starting from ground zero with medical experiments on the moon, long-term duration, the human physiology, what happens psychologically and so on. We're starting at ground zero.
These experiments. What do they hope to glean from taking saliva, wet and dry saliva samples before, during, and after the flight?
Well, I have to be careful because I'm not a medical doctor, but I can I can surmise that what they want to do is determine the effects of long-term duration living on the moon. So they'll take these saliva samples before you leave, take saliva samples after you get to the moon and over a period of time, and then they'll compare the two. And the idea is to determine what effects long-term duration living on the moon has on the human body. You know, because how has the body changed? You know, how has the body's production of saliva changed? Because that's a reflection of everything else that's going on in the body.
These avatars are really interesting because they are essentially chips. If I understand this right, they're chips that stand in for the astronauts. They're the size of a thumb drive. If you can, tell me more about that.
Yeah, and I wish I could, but I don't know much more about it than you do, other than AI and microelectronics and micro chips and micro robotics are playing an increasingly important role in the overall evolution of space exploration. I can put it that way without going into a whole lot of detail that I am not privy to.
They tell us that the first astronauts that went to the moon did so with computer technology. We have more computer technology in our smartphones than they had in the Apollo capsules, if I'm correct about this. So yes. Compare the difference. What will Artemis have available to it in terms of computer power?
Oh, my goodness. Orders of magnitude above what the early astronauts had. Artemis will be able to autonomously enter orbit, autonomously dock. Now, let's back up. Artemis 2, as you say, will not go to the moon, partially because the gateway, the part that will take astronauts from orbit to the moon, is not ready yet. Artemis 3, when that part is ready, Artemis rocket will have to dock to Gateway, then Gateway will take people up and down. So Artemis 3 will have the capability of autonomous navigation, autonomous docking. It will have improved diagnostic systems for the vehicle itself. It will have improved diagnostics for the astronauts, improved navigation, improved life support. All of those things are orders of magnitude better than what the astronauts had during the old Apollo days. Compare a modern vehicle today, a Tesla automobile, with a Model T. That's the difference between Apollo and Artemis. The Model T would get you from point A to point B safely, but not nearly in as much style and safety and accuracy as a modern Tesla.
Yeah, the Mercury capsules were smaller than a phone booth, I think, or maybe.
they're very small.
How do you compare the space in the Artemis capsule to the space in the Apollo capsules?
Much, much, much bigger. In fact, I would have been too tall for the Apollo program. I'm about 6'1". The astronauts in the Apollo program, I think the height limit was 5'11", or thereabouts. So the capsules were very, very small. And if people come to visit us, I'm digressing a little bit here at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex, they'll be able to see we have the actual Apollo 14 capsule on display. They can get up close and personal and see how small it is. Well, the modern capsule, now the Orion capsule in Artemis, is going to hold four people. They've got much more room up there, and it's much more comfortable. The suits that they wear will be more comfortable. Life support system, everything is just, orders of magnitude, better and more comfortable and human friendly than it was back in the old Apollo days.
Space has been used so far for peaceful exploration, both of planets and scientific experiments in the space station and the satellites that we put into orbit around the Earth. Both us and every other country, it seems, in the world have satellites orbiting the Earth for various different reasons, including this is how we get clear television pictures and weather forecasts now that we couldn't do in the 1960s. But let's talk about weaponization, because the 1967 Outer Space Treaty calls for no nuclear weapons or other weapons of mass destruction in orbit or outer space, including the moon, no military bases or weapons testing. The moon and other celestial bodies is supposed to be used strictly for peaceful purposes. But now, the United States has something called Space Force, which is a military service under the Air Force to, among other things, protect U.S. assets in space, meaning, I guess, the satellites that orbit the Earth, among other things. Purely defensive for the moment. But do you think that agreement can hold as more and more nations get into space travel and begin landing on the moon? As more commercial entities find their way into space, can we stay peaceful?
Well, I could only tell you that I sure hope we can. And the Space Force was reactionary. Remember, China had already been militarizing space for years before we ever formed a Space Force. In fact, China was the first nation to demonstrate they could shoot down a satellite in orbit. So that's a clear signal to the U.S. that we ought to stand up and be prepared to protect our assets and protect ourselves. So the Space Force, I think, was necessary. It's unfortunate, but it's necessary. We have to be able and willing to meet the threats that might come from space. And you're right, the space treaties that were formed back in the 60s were signed by the large spacefaring nations. We signed, I think Europe did, Russia, and so on. And everybody agrees to these treaties, but other countries who might enter the space race did not necessarily sign into them. And some of those countries may be adversarial to the United States. Yeah. It's unfortunate, but that's the world that we live in. And we
you mentioned that it's important for us to get to the South Pole of the moon, because that's where we think water in the form of ice is, and where water is, we can sustain life and I guess mine for water and filter it and turn it into from ice to liquid, etc. Do you see that becoming a problem? Because if China has the same goal, no matter who gets there first, they may say, this is ours, you stay away. Are we going to say, this is ours, you stay away?
No, I don't believe so. If I could, if you look at the history of the United States, we do not operate that way unless we're threatened. The United States is a pretty good country about sharing what we do and what we have.
We haven't until now.
I'm sorry, what?
We haven't until now.
No, I don't think that the United States will bar other countries from utilizing. I think we'll just ensure that we have access. We get the first. We'll have access, but we'll say, all others, please come and work with us. Whereas other countries, some of them get there first. They will say, no, you stay away. We don't want you here. And if you come close, we're going to shoot you. You know, that is not our history. Our history has been wonderful.
How important is it for us to find water? What if we don't find sufficient water to make a difference?
Then we would not be able to have a sustained presence on the moon. You know, we know this, human beings require water to live, and the moon is too far away to ferry water back and forth. We've got to be able to learn to live off the land. That in situ living is what we're trying to do. We have to be able to do that. When we go off to Mars, we have to figure out how to live and work off the land on Mars. So it's the same thing with any other planet that we go to. It has to have the fundamental building blocks of human life. Otherwise, we will not survive there.
I have about a minute left. To be an astronaut, to be a successful astronaut, to be part of a team, you're part of a team. You have to listen. You have to work together. And I'm thinking that maybe you have experience in this on the ground, because in addition to being a test pilot and an astronaut in residence at the Kennedy Space Flight Center, you also play the trumpet. You have a degree in music from Florida State. You still perform, I'm told, with the Winston Scott Cosmic Jazz Ensemble. What kind of music do you play?
Oh, as you just said, it's jazz primarily. And, you know, it's not unusual that people who do mathematical or scientific things are also musicians. You know, I point out that Albert Einstein played violin, and even John Glenn played trumpet in his high school band. You know, we had an astronaut band there in Houston. We had other bands with engineers and astronauts and so on. It may be unusual to have an academic degree in music, but it's not unusual that astronauts are also musicians. But yes, I play regularly, enjoy it. And the guys and gals that back me up are the professional musicians here in the area. They make their living playing music, but thoroughly enjoy it.
Winston Scott's NASA's shuttle astronaut on both Endeavour and Columbia, and the resident astronaut of the Kennedy Space Center Visitors Complex. Also the author of a book called Reflections from Earth Orbit, which was written back in 2005. Thank you so much for the hour.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much, man.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.